It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Later in the program, we'll talk to Steely Dan co-founder Donald Fagen. He'll talk about his life in the music business, his influences, and how he really feels about the touring life.
First, we take a look at some new poll numbers out today from Marquette University Law School.
The latest poll covers topics like the government shutdown, the 2016 presidential outlook, and Wisconsin's upcoming governor's race, which looks kind of competitive, at least according to these numbers.
Joining us now is Charles Franklin, director of the Marquette University Law School poll and professor of law and public policy. He's also the co-founder of Pollster.com and founder of PollsandVotes.com. Charles, welcome to Central Time.
Good to be here.
I want to start with the governor's race. Now, we're still pretty far out from that election, but the information is starting to trickle in. What did your poll find regarding Governor Walker and Democratic challenger Mary Burke?
Yeah, I think it's important to realize that we are still a year out, and Mary Burke has only been in the race for barely 3 weeks. But what we found was a very tight race. Walker led Burke 47-45%. That's inside the margin of error. Walker also led State Senator Kathleen Vinehout 47-44, almost the same. We also tested Representative Peter Barca. Walker led there 48-42. You don't see very much difference between the three different Democrats. And the race is close in all three cases. What that shows is that voters are judging this race based on their feelings towards Walker and whether they approve of him or disapprove of him, because in other questions we see that 70% said they were unable to say whether they had a favorable or unfavorable view of Mary Burke. Even more couldn't rate the other two Democrats. So what we're seeing is people bring their partisanship and, of course, the accumulation of the controversy over Act 10 and then the recall race, voters have had a lot of time to decide whether they like Walker or not, regardless of who the Democrat is.
Now, I think you've been at this a while. Do you have any sense about whether when the race is this far out that these numbers tend to see a lot of movement as you get closer and closer to the election?
Absolutely. A poll a year out is important to see how are we starting this process. But this poll has virtually nothing to do in terms of predicting where the vote will be 12 months from now. The next 12 months, we will see the governor and whoever the Democratic candidate ends up being crafting their campaign. In the case of the Democrat, introducing themselves to voters, telling them who they are, and telling them what issues are important to their campaign and why those issues matter to the voters. Those are the things that ultimately are going to be more important come November 2014. This is simply the starting point, but the starting point right now that we're seeing is that voters remain, more than a year after the recall, still pretty sharply and pretty evenly divided over Governor Walker.
Now, is this poll among adults or among likely voters?
Neither. It's registered voters.
Gotcha.
We interviewed 800 registered voters, and we interviewed them by both landline and cell phone using live interviewers for the interview.
Well, jobs also continue to be a hot-button issue here in Wisconsin. What do Wisconsinites think about the way the state is heading right now?
We see opinion shifting in two opposite directions on this. We've been asking a question about whether people believe the state is adding jobs faster than other states, about the same as other states, or lagging behind other states. And in our new data in October, 14% say faster than other states, 37 say the same, and 41 say we're lagging behind other states. But that is a shift from July, when 48% said we were lagging behind, and fewer, just 8%, said we were adding jobs faster than other states. Now, we've had a significant advertising campaign talking up the governor's job record between the July survey and this one, but there have also been changes in the real world. So an interesting question is how much of this is due to the advertising campaign, how much is due to real world changes, and how does that affect voters' opinions going into the ultimate race next year?
And what about some of the other big issues on the table? You know, there are some key issues like income tax cut that just recently went through. The Kenosha Casino is on the table as well. What about some of those other issues out there?
We went through a range of policies that the legislature passed and the governor signed over this last spring and summer. And we find a range. On the issue of tax cuts, voters are broadly pretty supportive of both the property tax cut and income tax cuts. Over 50% approve those, and less than 40% oppose them. School vouchers are still fairly popular. 50% approve, and 44% oppose those. But other things push against the governor and the legislature. More people oppose ending residency requirements for city and municipal workers, and 56% oppose requiring an ultrasound before an abortion. 38% support that. Finally, the governor decided not to take federal money to expand Medicaid for those just over the poverty line. That decision is opposed by 56%. 36% support that opinion. So what you see across that range of issues is some that lean in a Republican direction, but others that lean in a Democratic direction. That, again, shows why the upcoming race could be pretty malleable. Finally, on the casino, opinion is very evenly split. 41% support a casino in Kenosha, but 38% oppose, and one in five, 19%, say they haven't thought enough about it to have an opinion.
Interesting. You know, if you're Governor Walker, do you have any idea how, you know, this poll gets perceived?
Well, I think that it's not probably surprising that voters have firm and strong, well-settled views of the governor. I think so in that sense, a close race right now simply ratifies the results we've seen all year in terms of his job approval and favorability rating, where he's been a little more approved than disapproved, but only by 2 to 4 percentage points. So that would have suggested that we would be in the situation we're in now. I think the bigger issue is, over the course of 12 months, how do the candidates, and especially the Democratic candidate, introduce themselves to voters and lay out the table of issues that they think are important to voters and give voters a reason to vote for them rather than Governor Walker? And from Governor Walker's point of view, how does he present his record of achievements to voters in a way that persuades them to reelect him? I think that's really the dynamic part, and we're still a good ways off before that becomes the focus of attention for most of the public.
Now, we talked about being a ways out on the governor's race, and speaking of that, the same is true of the presidential race coming up in 2016. But you did ask some questions about that. What did you find?
Yes, because it's catnip. We just can't not ask about the
you gotta
presidential
ask.
Race. And there is some interesting results there. When we asked Republican voters about 2016, Governor Walker was in first place with 29%. Congressman Paul Ryan was just behind him at 25%. And then there was a big drop-off to Marco Rubio in third place. This is a shift from May, when we first asked the question, when Walker was in third place in the mid-teens. So there has been some movement there. When we asked those same Republicans would they like to see Walker run for president, 52% said they would, but 43% said they did not want to see him run. In contrast, for Congressman Ryan, 64% wanted him to run, 27% did not. So that's an interesting dynamic for two politicians from just down the road from each other, both of whom have a plausible shot at a presidential campaign.
Well, Charles, interesting stuff. Thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Charles Franklin is the director of the Marquette University Law School Poll and a professor of law and public policy.
In the last 40 years, there have been few bands that have shaken up the music scene quite like Steely Dan. Their blend of jazz and rock, funk, R&B led to success in the 70s. And since the band reunited, they're still touring. Just wrapped up a tour, I believe, earlier this month.
Now in a new memoir, the co-founder of the band, Donald Fagen, talks about his musical influences and gives readers a behind-the-scenes look at a recent concert tour, which is often a brutally honest account of his life on the road.
Donald Fagen joins us. He's a Rock and Roll Hall of Fame inductee. His career includes solo albums in addition to his work with Steely Dan. His new book is called Eminent Hipsters. Donald, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thank you.
Well, let's talk about that term. First of all, eminent hipsters. Who are you talking about there?
Well, a hipster has many definitions, I think, depending on your age and subculture and so on. But I'm using it in this particular book just to describe certain artists or performers that I used to listen to or read when I was a kid that had an influence on me.
And Henry Mancini was one of those, and I loved reading about that. I'm a big fan of some of the same songs you mentioned. Mm-hmm. Why Henry Mancini? Talk about him a little.
Well, I think, I must have been 9 or 10 when this TV show called Peter Gunn on TV, and I think that was probably the first time a lot of people heard Henry Mancini's music. He composed this jazz score that was really a lot of people had never heard what was then called cool jazz before hearing that music on TV. And a lot of people who later became jazz fans were introduced to jazz through his music.
Well, I hadn't thought about it listening to Steely Dan in the past, but with the horn section and the different kind of chord progressions, I mean, is there a straight or at least a curvy line from the cool jazz of Henry Mancini and others to at least some of Steely Dan's music?
Well, I think, of course, as I got older, I started to listening to the perhaps more authentic music that Henry Mancini was essentially using as a model for his music. So I, heard a lot of West Coast jazz and then started listening to jazz of all kinds. So I think he was one of the influences among many.
And then you mentioned people you listen to and people you read, and you talk about growing up as a fan of science fiction.
Mm-hmm.
What got you into science fiction?
I remember I bought up one of those science fiction magazines. Could have been Galaxy or Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction, these monthly magazines that had stories in them that people used to buy at the time.
And any favorite authors that really stuck with you?
Well, in those days, I guess now they call it the golden age of science fiction, the 50s and early 60s, and there was, Heinlein, Ray Bradbury, Alfred Bester, Philip K. Dick, all these terrific writers.
Now, you mentioned delving deeper into the world of jazz, hitting jazz clubs, I think in your preteen years almost. You talk about jazz clubs back then and jazz clubs now. How do they compare? How do they stack up then and now?
First of all, in those days, jazz clubs were not nearly as expensive. You could really, for a few dollars, go see a whole night of jazz at the Vanguard or the Five Spot, one of those clubs. And these days, it really costs a fortune just to see one set. So that's one thing. And in those days, it was just much more casual. Everyone was smoking and. It was a whole different scene. The whole atmosphere was different.
It was on the margins, kind of maybe more, I don't know, outsider-y or transgressive or something. And now it's like an establishment.
Well, I think, the music was new. First of all, it was a great time for jazz. You had this kind of post-bop thing was happening. You had I saw Charles Mingus, I saw Coltrane, Thelonious Monk. Were in great periods then. I saw, and then I saw some older guys like Coleman Hawkins and Earl Hines and people like that. So it was a great sort of a jazz history lesson.
Well, tell us about the birth of the band Steely Dan.
I was going to school at Bard College in upstate New York, and I met my partner Walter Becker, who was a student a couple years behind me, and I heard him playing guitar in this campus club, and we started writing songs together. And then eventually, We ended up in Los Angeles as staff writers for a record company called ABC Dunhill. We would write songs for the artists on the label, but we weren't very good at that, so we knew we had to start a band.
It was harder to write for other people than to write for your own band?
It was for us. We were terrible, terrible pop songwriters. Our stuff sounded like ripoffs of stuff that was on the radio. It was, you know, we couldn't be original in that particular form.
But you came up with a pretty unique, I would say, unique original sound as Steely Dan. What was the difference there?
Well, we had these two notebooks. One was the pop songbook where we were writing songs for other people, and this other notebook we called the stuff in that book the Dynamite. And we thought, like, this is the stuff like we were born to write, but we knew we needed a band as a vehicle because we knew that the chords were too jazzy and mm-hmm. the lyrics were too crazy to give to other people. We'd need our own band.
Well, as I mentioned, you did a lot of solo work between then and now. When you look back at the hits of the 70s for Steely Dan, how do you feel about them today, and how do you feel about playing them on a tour now?
I enjoy playing them. In fact, I think, most of the audience is there to hear, stuff from the 70s and, you know, maybe a few more newer things. But we like to, we know that there's some fans who like to hear really deep cuts, and we play a few of those. But I think, most of the fans are there because they want to hear these tunes that they remember from when they were kids or that their parents played or their parents are there to hear those tunes. What we do is we arrange them, and we're not that strict about playing them exactly like the record, so the band does have a lot of leeway, so it's there. We make them fun to play for us, too.
I mentioned you had a Steely Dan tour this year. Last year, you had a different tour with Michael McDonald, I think, and Boz Scaggs, and
right.
A lot of your book is chronicling that. People may have an image of the glamorous rock and roll lifestyle on tour. That is not how you describe it.
No.
What is it like? It you make it sound not fun in some ways to be on tour.
Yeah. Well, touring was never a great fun thing for me. Even back when I was a kid in the 70s, it was always a bit of a grind. I think I just didn't have the constitution or the personality for it or something like that. But it doesn't get that much easier when you get older either. So I started to keep a journal every night. This was in the summer of 2012. And, I sent it to this publisher, and he thought it was very funny. So it's basically a fairly realistic. I exaggerate some things to get a laugh, but essentially it tells you how a lot of musicians think when they're on the road.
And you diagnosed yourself with acute tour disorder.
Yeah, that's right. I made that up. But it's essentially after 2 or 3 weeks on the road, you know, something goes funny in the head, you know. And I think the way you cope with it is part of what the journal is about.
Well, and you've mentioned stage fright over the years, even panic attacks. I mean, how bad does it get as you're getting up on stage? Does it interfere with your ability to go up and perform?
I don't really get panic attacks anymore. I used to in the 70s, actually, but now I don't get so much of that. But as the tour goes on and you get kind of sort of physically drained and, emotionally drained, after a while, like, sometimes you'll be on stage and you'll start having, strange fantasies while you're singing, or get kind of paranoid, that kind of thing.
So what's next on your agenda? Another Steely Dan album or some solo work? Another fun rip-roaring tour?
Well, yeah, Steely Dan was out this past summer and fall, and I think we're going to be doing some touring starting in the spring, I believe. That's what it looks like now.
All right. Well, just briefly, Deborah in Milwaukee called in and wanted to let you know you were an integral part of her childhood.
Well, thank you very much.
Hopefully that'll pep you up for the next time you come here to Wisconsin. All right, Donald, thank you so much for being here today.
And thank you.
That was Steely Dan co-founder Donald Fagen. We've been talking in part about his new memoir. It's called Eminent Hipsters. Welcome to to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're gearing up for Halloween here at Central Time, clearly. And we have a special guest here to help. She's an expert in all things strange, freaky, and terrifying. And she's here to talk about her new book on creatures of the night.
Do you have a favorite creature of movie, legend, or literature? Vampires, maybe. Werewolves. Mermaids? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And tell us about your favorite Halloween-style creature. Or you can email, by the way, talk@wpr.org.
Those terrifying mermaids. Every time.
They're kind of scary.
Well, our guest is Varla Ventura. She's the author of Banshees, Werewolves, Vampires, and Other Creatures of the Night. She's the curator of the Wiser Magical Creatures and Paranormal Parlor series of ebooks, and is also the author of several other books, including The Book of the Bizarre and Among the Mermaids. Mm-hmm. Varla, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thank you for having me.
Well, you are billed as a person who loves all things strange, freaky, and terrifying. What is it that draws you to these kinds of stories and creatures?
Well, I think I was sort of raised in an environment that fostered a love of the strange. These are the kinds of books of folklore and magic that were on my mother's bookshelves. We always had tarot cards and Ouija boards around. Halloween was probably a bigger deal than Christmas in many, by most accounts. And in fact, we usually left our Halloween decorations up for Christmas.
I know those
so,
houses.
And not to say that my mother was particularly morbid. She just sort of fostered a love for monsters in me from a young age.
Hmm. Well, in this book, you're focusing on banshees, werewolves, and vampires. Why those three?
Well, you know, there's really thousands of creatures of the night. I felt that werewolves and vampires are certainly, you can't write a book about creatures of the night without including them. And they've certainly been, you know, getting a lot of press in years of late. And banshees don't get quite as much press, but they are certainly more terrifying in many regards than many of the other creatures of the night. So I think I had to pick three that I had the most material on, and those were the three that kept repeatedly coming up.
And your book is a collection of sort of older literature and some modern stuff too, but it seems as though the people that you're sharing their accounts, they're believers.
Oh, certainly. I think that was one of the things that I sort of discovered in curating the ebook collection that then sort of melded into a couple of books, the mermaid book that you mentioned, Among the Mermaids, and then this book that just came out, were sort of born in this research of volumes of forgotten lore. And it was really wonderful to learn about the secret lives of these upstanding citizens and their beliefs in ghosts and their penchant for writing horror.
Well, I want to start with banshees. That's where your book starts. And before I started, I thought, banshees, how scary can they be? And then it turned out that they were really scary. And when I was done, I had to reassure myself by telling myself that I wasn't Irish and I didn't come from an old Irish family, so I was probably okay. But can you tell us about banshees and where some of that lore comes from?
Certainly. I would have to agree with you. I think I entered into it not realizing, thinking they were more of a beautiful creature. But I think in many regards, banshees are the scariest. They're more equated with a ghost than with a supernatural creature like a werewolf. They have their, for the most part, accounts are of banshees being quite beautiful, but there are many times when they are sort of horrible hags. And the scariest thing about them is not how they look or how they sound. It's what they mean. If you see a banshee, it means that somebody, yourself or somebody that you love, usually in your family, is going to die. So that's pretty scary.
And they seem to have a particular foothold in Ireland.
Yeah, I mean the original banshee as we know it is specific to Ireland. Parts of Wales and Scotland have creatures with very similar names, And so it's kind of throughout the UK and even in Brittany, there are very similar creatures. And then there are sort of the counterparts of the banshee that exist cross-culturally in other places. And there are a few accounts of something for all intents and purposes sounds just like a banshee. It's just called something else. But the banshee, as I first describe it, is the Irish banshee.
Could you tell us a story or two from your banshee lore?
Yes, well, I'd love to. one of my favorite stories actually is this story. There's a man named Elliot O'Donnell, and he was probably the foremost researcher on banshees. He wrote a massive volume all about banshees and other Irish ghosts in the late 1800s. And what was interesting about him is that he actually had an inherited family ghost. His family was haunted by a banshee, and he took his scholarship very seriously in his collection of stories. He was sort of like the Grimm brothers collected stories throughout Europe and Eastern Europe. He did that with Irish folklore and banshees specifically. And what was key about him is that he was a believer. He had had paranormal experiences as a child, and this led him sort of down the path. But he was also many things. He was a policeman in the United States for a while. He was an actor. He had kind of this wild and rich life. And he told this wonderful story about presenting to the Irish Literary Society his theory. He was the first person to say that not all banshees are beautiful women in the guise of luring you out into the dark of the night to leave you in the cold to die. He said, they're not all like that. There's many different kinds. And a woman stands up in the audience and she says, she protests that he has made this declaration. She doesn't protest it because she doesn't believe in banshees. She protests it because her banshee is beautiful. And I just love that story because it sort of shows how integrated into the Irish way of thinking that the existence of banshees were. So you're not left going, our banshees are real. It's more about the debate of what they look like and, you know, who's the foremost authority on it.
One interesting detail seems to be that if they're the old hags with the evil eyes, they will shriek and laugh maniacally. But if they are, you know, sort of the beautiful, friendlier banshees, they will sing you a chorus instead.
That's true. And they also are, you know, terribly sad. Many of the banshees are either they died in childbirth or perhaps they lost a child or in some way caused the death of their child. And so it's believed that that is the reason that they sort of keen and mourn so intensively.
Well, let's move on from banshees and talk about another of the creatures of the night in your book, werewolves. And you write that we tend to feel pity and empathy for werewolves. Why would that be?
Yeah, you know, I do believe that one of our... I mean, we sort of lust after vampires and banshees, maybe we fear, but with werewolves, it could be the dog-like quality that leads us to have some sympathy for them. But I also think that we all sort of have an ability, we have it within us to be werewolf-like. We've all had moments of rage, and there are many accounts of, you know, humans that go sort of beyond the pale and you know, into furious frenzies of murder and mayhem. So I think that there's many of us who can kind of relate to that, just that moment when you completely lose control. And then the other thing is that werewolves are, you know, they are only that sort of ferocious beast under certain circumstances. And much of the folklore are accounts of werewolves trying to hide the fact that they're a werewolf or trying to run away because they don't want to hurt the people that they love. So I think that, again, that has to do with sort of our own ability to understand that and our connection with, you know, man's best friend and the way that we view a werewolf more as a companion, perhaps.
Interesting companion. Well, we're talking right now to Varla Ventura. She's the author of Banshees, Werewolves, Vampires, and Other Creatures of the Night.
And we want to hear from you. Do you have a favorite creature of the night, and why? Do you have a favorite representation of a vampire or a werewolf in film, TV, or fiction? Do you have a family legend about one of these creatures you can share with us? You can call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you could post on the Central Time Facebook page. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
We're talking with Varla Ventura about our favorite monsters. She's the author of Banshees, Werewolves, Vampires, and Other Creatures of the Night.
Our guest is fascinated by these monsters. Are you? Do you have a vampire obsession, whether we're talking film, fiction, or legend, or werewolves, or you name it? Or do you have a question about these creatures of the night? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And Varla, we were talking about werewolves just a little bit ago, and Wisconsin, it turns out, has had its share of connections with werewolf sightings and legends. Could you tell us about one of the first?
Oh, sure. Wisconsin has had many, many weird happenings. One of the first werewolf sightings, it was the first in Wisconsin and one of the first documented in the U.S., was in 1936. And it was a man named Mark Shackleman who was driving along Highway 18, and he spied a dark figure digging up an old Native American mound. As he got closer, he realized the creature stood well over 6 feet tall and was covered in hair. The creature had a face that resembled something between that of an ape and a dog. Shackleman noticed that the creature had three human-like fingers on each hand and smelled of rotting meat. Scared, but intrigued, Shackleman returned to the same spot the following night in the hopes of getting another look. This time he was shocked not only to find the creature again, but also to hear him speak. Astounded by what he thought was a neo-human language, he immediately sensed that the creature was evil and retreated to a safe spot. After that incident, he never saw the creature again. And actually, there are several other sightings. Another one that I included in the book was also along Highway 18, and that was in 1964. A man named Dennis Fulis spotted a very similar creature as he was driving home from work. He said that with his headlights on, he was able to see a large animal weighing between 400 and 500 pounds running across the highway. He figured the creature was at least 7 feet tall and covered in coarse brown fur.
I have to figure where Highway 18 is so I can stay away from it. I don't know.
Yeah. if your listeners have.
I'm sure they have. Actually, call and let us know where Highway 18 is and if you live on it, if you've seen any werewolves on it. Interesting history there. And there's another interesting story about werewolves in Wisconsin, and it has to do with Native American legend as well. And supposedly this story ends with the birth of the father of werewolves. Can you tell us a bit about that one?
Certainly. This sort of goes along with a lot of the Native American stories of shapeshifting or skinwalkers. That's another term for them. There was a tribe that was in Wisconsin, and they were under the guidance of a spirit known as Wiska Kachek, and I'm going to apologize for probably not saying that correctly. Wiska Kachek was a shapeshifter who sought refuge in the woods and had a friendly relationship with humans. There were two boys that were part of the tribe that approached Wiska Kachek because they had been out hunting and they were starving. They couldn't find enough food to feed the tribe. And so the legend is that Wiska Kachek granted these two boys the ability to shapeshift into werewolves, and on the stipulation that they could only use it to hunt. They could never use this ability to hurt another human being. Well, you give a couple boys an ability like this, and, you know, it's inevitable that someone's going to make them mad. And, in fact, that's what happened with one of the boys. He got into an argument, got angry at this other guy, and killed him. When Wiska Kachek found out, he banished him, and that sort of evolved into the one of the first. He is known as the father of the werewolves.
And we have a couple of questions from callers who couldn't stay on the line. Mike in Madison wants to know if you know about the Salampa, which is a ghost in Panama and Colombia.
I do not.
All right. Well, Mike, you might have to call and tell us more about that one.
You need to tell us. Yeah.
You've stumped our monster expert. And Catherine in Cameron wants to hear about silkies.
Selkies, well, I love Selkies. I definitely got a lot more into Selkies with my book Mermaids, Among the Mermaids. Selkies are essentially very similar to a mermaid. They, although they are half seal and half human, usually female. And there's a lot of legends surrounding them. And many people still to this day, when you look out at a Selkie, especially in the British Isles and Ireland specifically, and Scotland as well, you'll see many seals with human eyes. Now, the seal can come on land, and she can bury she can take her coat off. As long as she knows where her coat is, she can stay, and she can be the wife to a mortal and have children and, you know, have a wonderful life. But as soon as somebody discovers her coat, she's forced to go back to the sea. And there's been several wonderful movies. The Secret of Ronan-ish was based on this legend.
Hmm. Are they scary at all, Silkies, or are they just sort of, I don't know, poignant?
You know, I think they're scary to a certain extent in that we definitely romanticize mermaids and Selkies. But in a real encounter, I think you'd find that there's a certain element of sort of a supernatural terror that might seize you in the moment.
I can imagine that. And, you know, that brings me to another point. I want to ask you, you've been on the trail of the paranormal for a long time. This is something you're deeply fascinated with. Do you believe that there are things that we cannot explain away?
Absolutely. I consider myself a supernaturalist. I believe in the possibility and the existence of many, many things beyond our regular sight and beyond the veil, sort of. And I think also that it serves us a specific purpose, as I think legends and stories have always served us. And that allows us to suspend belief long enough to sort of tap into a very creative and infinite part of our brain that I think we need in order to think outside the box and to come up with, you know, new solutions to everyday problems. Sometimes you've just got to, it's the same reason I think we check out and watch a horror movie or even a sitcom. It allows us to kind of believe that something exists outside of our day-to-day drone.
Do you have a favorite story from this book that especially resonates with you, or a favorite creature?
I think my favorite, well, I'm hard-pressed to say my favorite story, but certainly one of my favorite stories. There's a vampire story that's in the book that is called Le Motte Amoureux, or Claremond, as it's known. And the guy who wrote it was a very interesting fellow. He wrote, he was a friend with Victor Hugo, and he had, you know, kind of this whole alternate life. And it's a somewhat unknown vampire story, and for that reason I decided to include it in its entirety in the book. It's not terribly long. And without giving it away, I will tell you that it involves a priest, a vampire, and some rather sordid, it was written in, I believe, 1909, and for the times it was quite quite sordid. There's nothing too graphic in there, but there's some things that it implies. But it's a beautifully written story, and it's not very well known, and it's kind of scary, actually.
Yeah, I started that one. I haven't finished it yet, so now I'll have to read the rest of it, maybe, maybe on Halloween. Well, as long as we're talking about vampires, you know, they have long been fascinating to people, I guess because they're supposed to be so crazily beautiful and, you know, kind of lusty, too. What do you think it is that's appealing about vampires?
Well, I mean, personally, I've always liked, you know, the pale with the black hair. I mean, that's kind of that sort of gothic look. I think, actually, just to get, you know, kind of more philosophical about it, I do think that because vampires have this connection to blood, that we have an emotional reaction to them. And there's something incredibly lusty about a bite on the neck. So I think that that's probably why we continue to romanticize vampires.
Now, Mary Shelley shows up in your book. She's the author of Frankenstein. How is the author of the first English vampire story related to her?
The first vampire story published in English was published 70 years before Dracula, actually. And there's the wonderful story that Mary Shelley, Percy Bysshe Shelley, and her sister and Lord Byron were at this lake house on Lake Geneva in Switzerland, and they had, it was a sort of a dark and stormy night, and they said, everybody write a ghost story and we'll see whose is the scariest. And they were sort of known for doing these kind of like ghostly experiments. And Mary Shelley that night wrote her outline for what became Frankenstein. Now, Lord Byron wrote a short story, a sketch of a short story about a character and a novel called The Vampire. Lord Byron had a personal physician by the name of John William Polidori, and Byron threw the story out. He said, "This is trite. I'm not going. This is not my thing." But Polidori, on that night, kind of took that idea and ran with it. And with Byron's permission, he turned that idea of Lord Byron's into a full-length novel, and that became The Vampire. Which is, again, was the first vampire story published in English.
Interesting. So a lot happened on that dark and stormy night.
Busy night, yeah.
All right.
Been there.
Well, Varla, thank you so much for joining us today, and have a happy Halloween.
Oh, thank you. Happy Halloween, and happy Halloween to all your listeners.
We've been talking to Varla Ventura. She's the author of Banshees, Werewolves, Vampires, and Other Creatures of the Night.
Coming up next, it's the news. Then we'll talk about the video game sensation Minecraft. Our guest says it's the most creative game ever made for a computer. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.